I'm Ben Fry. I'm 50 years old. This is March 29th, 2012. We're here in Little Rock, Arkansas. And my relationship to Ann Nicholson is that I have worked with her for 23 years now, and I would say we're also friends.
And I would second that. I'm Ann Nicholson, and I am up for grabs as far as age is concerned. This is March the 29th, 2012, and this is in Little Rock, Arkansas. And Ben is officially my boss. He's the station manager, and I'm a part-time employee of the university. But we, as Ben has said, have known each other for a long time, and it has been one of the finer points of my life.
Well, thank you so much.
Isn't that nice?
It is nice. I want to talk, I have never actually gotten it very straight about like where you were and when you were at different times in your life, because you've moved around so much.
True.
And so I just want to kind of go through the different places you've been and what life was like in some of those different places. Now, you were born in India, right?
But only then was it India. Since then, and partition, where I was born is now Pakistan.
Oh, is that right? Mm-hmm. Okay.
In what romantically could be called the foothills of the Himalayas.
Okay. So you were over in what would be East Pakistan, I guess.
No. It's north of Pindi and the cities that are always in the news because they're the larger cities. This was a hill station to which mothers and children went when the weather got too hot in the plains. And so my mother-to-be and I were in Murree, this hill station on the road up to Kashmir. And I was born there.
Okay. And your father was British military.
Right. He was a doctor in the Royal Army Medical Corps. And he was stationed up there, and that's where my mother and he met.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
What was your mother doing there?
She was the daughter of an army officer who was stationed there, too.
What was the... So there were these military bases, I guess, that...
Well, they don't have bases like they do here.
Yeah.
They have the barracks, the cantonments where the other ranks live, but the army officers, they have a club for the subalterns, the single officers, but most of the married officers, and there were quite a few of them because India was always fun for the women to go to, would find houses in the area. And so...
Did you live with the natives of the area? Did you live kind of among... No, you did...
Where the British lived would be away from where the Indians would have their houses and their compounds. But we had servants, of course. And
they were Indians?
Mm-hmm, yes. Except for our nanny and people like that. But we all had, as babies, all the British couples with babies would have Ayahs who would look after the...
Ayahs?
A-Y-A-H. It was an Indian nurse with the white sari.
Oh, okay.
And they were usually paid much more than they would have been able to get. But I don't know at all from awful lot about that, but we always had what they called a bearer, which was like a maitre d' butler who would be the head of the household, very dignified. And he would speak excellent English. So we never had to learn an Indian language, except that our parents insisted that we did learn a bit of Urdu to be able to speak to the servants. And
what are your parents' names?
My mother's name was Vi. She and my father was Ronald, but he was always called Dickie. That was his surname, and everybody called him Dickie. He was from Scotland, and he had gone...
Was your mother from Scotland?
No, she was born in India, too. Her father was in the Indian Army, which was a part of the British Army system in India, that there would be... senior officer on the manifest of the Indian Army. So it says IA, but he was very British. Unfortunately for a lot of people, when you move to foreign countries, they don't realize that he was in the Indian Army, that he wasn't Indian. And as he was born in Japan, it made it difficult, even so, to know exactly where this particular family came from, but he was very British, went to school, as we all did, boarding school in England.
But he served at one point in the British Army in Japan, is that what you're saying?
No, he was born in Japan. His father was a civilian who had been a clipper ship captain.
Yeah.
And had loved Japan and lived there. The family was from Yorkshire. And they transported the cotton from the sheep and the wool from Yorkshire through, which was a big port on the North Sea, round the Cape to America, to Japan. And he more or less settled there, and the family history relates that he, as an engineer, helped the Japanese establish their railway system.
So this was your grandfather we're talking about, right?
Yes. This would have been my great-grandfather, who was the clipper ship captain.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay.
And so all his family grew up in Japan.
Yeah, so he ended up eventually in India.
In Britain, he was sent to the army, to one of the army boarding schools, a place called Wellington. And when he graduated, he automatically went into the army, and wherever they posted him, and they posted him to India.
And then he raised his family there, including your
pretty
mother.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. And, of course, the World Wars, both one and two, disrupted a lot of what would have been a more or less regular transition, you know, from one place to the other. And so during the First World War was when my father went into the army, because he was at university just before it started. And he had made some friends in University of Glasgow, and they decided that they would study medicine and go as junior officers into the army and fight for Britain.
So so they met and married. And do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have two sisters.
Two sisters.
One was born in England and one was born in India.
Okay.
The middle one was born in England because the system was that you were posted to anywhere in the world, if you were with the military particularly, for about 5 years, and then 6 months home leave. Home, always with a capital H, was England.
Right.
And the one born in England was in the leave in the early 1930s when Mummy and Daddy were in England.
Are you the youngest or the oldest?
The oldest,
okay. And how long did you, I mean, with the exception of these leave times, how long did you live in India?
Well, apart from that 6 months, up until my teens.
Okay.
So the year that we left was the year after the war, Second World War ended, 1946. We traveled back to England because up until that point, anybody in a far distant place was left there. They weren't transported back if they were civilians because the space was needed on the ships and all the liners were turned into troop ships. There were no airlines in those days.
Yeah, yeah. You went to a boarding school at some point.
Yes, I went to one in Kashmir that was put together for the children of those of us stranded in India during the war, which is a wonderful place. It was a horrible school, so I don't want to talk about it.
Well, okay, let's forget about boarding school for a minute. What about just the memories you have of growing up in India?
I remember the places so well that I could probably draw a map of each one. I loved India. And even now there are scents on the air and flowers and things that remind me of India. It's a beautiful country. And Kashmir was a marvel. There's poetry that is written that almost can evoke the beauty of places like that. But we lived on a houseboat, and you stayed on the houseboat while it moved from lake to lake. And the Shalimar Gardens that were built by the Mughal emperors are still there, or they were. They were beautiful. They're huge, stepwise up the side of the mountain, the foothills of the mountains. It's where I saw my first daisies. And when I visited our daughter and her husband in Spain years ago, they took me to Granada and to the Alhambra. And I went into this incredible building with a feeling of familiarity because the gardens were so similar, even though they don't have the wide open spaces of grass that they do in Kashmir. They still had the same sort of flowers and the roses, and the general ambiance was Moorish, was Indian, was Eastern. It was beautiful.
Just a beautiful place to grow up. What about the people? Did you integrate with the local people, or was it mostly other British, you know,
the children
that you played with or
yes.
friends that you had?
The early stages when we were in India before the war was very much, my father was sent to a position in wherever he was sent, we went. And if there were children, then we met up with them. If there weren't, then we had ourselves and our nannies and our governesses and were homeschooled until we went to the boarding school as a result of the war. We were due to go, as all children, and British children in India and other places, were sent home to boarding school at the age of about 10 or 12. And then they stayed there until they graduated, until the next time the parents came home on leave was the only time that you'd see them.
Yeah. So was that the only boarding school that you went to?
No, when we went back to England, I went to school in Scotland for a while, and I enjoyed that. And I shocked my mother when I told her years later that I felt if I'd stayed in Scotland, which in those days had a very high standard of education, I probably would have been an academic, because I was learning to love learning. And this included Latin and biology and chemistry and things that were taught us all in the class at the same level and taught easily, that you could understand what the books were saying because you had a teacher who knew them so well he could put them into language that made sense. But then we were shipped off to a boarding school because our parents left again. They went back east. And the English level was higher at the boarding school that we went to. So I was like 2 years behind, and there wasn't any coaching available. So you sort of muddled around. I did fine in English and history.
But beyond that?
But math and science and foreign languages. I took Latin 1 and 3 times, and French was pretty much the same. They just didn't teach them in India. Those were all what you learned after you went to school.
Where was it? I know you've told me before that you went to school with Judy Dench.
That was the one in York.
In England.
Yes, it was a wonderful Quaker school. Judy's family is very strong Quaker. Hmm. And York is in the middle of a lot of Quaker families. And there were Fries and Rountrees and Cadburys. They're all Quaker families that made chocolate.
Maybe that's where my family comes from.
Yes. And it's a school that had a very high standard of education. Its brainy ones went to Cambridge and Oxford on scholarships and did very well. And others went another route and did very well. And there were people who made their name in medicine and radio and television. And Judy is one of them. And there was another that was between us in age. Judy was my sister's friend. She was much younger than I. And Mary Ure was a very active actress, went to the same drama school as Judy and I and others went to. And she's in a film called Where Eagles Dare.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of it.
And The Storm on the Nile. It was a remake of a film based on a story by A.E.W. Medson called The Four Feathers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes. Where those who didn't go to war in the First World War were given a white feather.
White feather, yeah.
And there's some very good writers, both A.S. Byatt and her sister, Margaret Drabble, from the same school.
So what was your, what did you think, as you were finishing up school, what did you think you were going to do?
I wanted to be an actress. That's why I went to London to drama school. And then
I've never heard that before.
Haven't you?
No,
yeah.
That you went to drama school.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
May I ask the transition from India to back to Great Britain? What was that like? You were a teenager, yes?
Yeah, it was awful. It was cold and gray and did nothing but rain. It was sad because we had been brought up, particularly with my father, because my mother had not grown up in England, so she didn't have any English memories to talk about. But Daddy is a Scot and a Burns lover and a musician and a poet. He loved poetry. He introduced me to all kinds of literature. Scotland was a dream. And when we got to Scotland and stayed with his family in this dreary little seaside town, it just was, there was no color. All the trees had been cut down for the wire, and all the ornamental ironwork around the houses had been taken away for the war, and everything was rationed still. And
It didn't live up to your father's stories.
No. So when he finally retired, they were back in the Far East for a while and came home in 49. I was nearly finished with school, and my father retired. He'd been in the army since 1915, and this was 51. He had answered an advertisement for civil defense schools that were popping up around the country because of the scare of atomic warfare. Mm-hmm. And he had specialized in chemical warfare between the wars, when they were given the chance, if they wanted to stay in the army, to go into something that might put them into another track for promotion and things like that. And his two mates, who had persuaded him to go into the army at university, opted for surgery. And as you may not know, but it's very possible that you do, in medicine, the surgeons go up the ladder more quickly than the internists and general practice, make more money, and get the regimental improvements, as you might say. So they started the Second World War. They were both generals when Daddy was still a major. Mm. But Daddy had done this chemical warfare in the interim in the 20s, obviously because of his experience in the First World War. And he was, for one thing, he was at Gallipoli, which was something he never talked about. Mm. I only found this out through my sister, who had talked to the mother when they had times together, the one who stayed in England. And obviously had been at hospitals either back of the front or back in England when these gassed soldiers were coming. And he realized that this was the new face of warfare, so he studied it. So he got a job straight away at one of these civil defense schools, and it was in Scotland, in one of the most beautiful parts of Scotland, in Perthshire, just at the foot of the Tay, of Loch Tay, when the River Tay comes out of the loch and trundles down the hill. And it's scenery to die for. It's beautiful. And we had a lovely little cottage that was about 250 years old, I suppose. And it was right in the middle of Stevenson country, kidnapped, mentioned some of the places, and several of the romantic Scottish writers have put their stories in that same area, because a lot of the battles and the fortunes of the Second Rising, the Bonnie Prince Charlie Rebellion, all took part in that part of Scotland.
Things you'd read about your whole life.
Oh, yes. And there are lots of things there that are still there that you can trace back. In fact, there's a yew tree in a small village called Fortingall that they've traced back, they thought, about 2,000 years. There's a legend that Pontius Pilate was born in this little town because the Romans made their way up the river, as it was a tidal river, and the encampments and things that are being discovered. And they've discovered it's a lot older than that. It's between 5 and 10,000 years old, that yew tree.
Now, I got a little lost here. When you, when your father retired and went to the civil defense school as an instructor, how old were you at that point?
I was just finished school.
Okay. And then, and so at that point, you were, when that was going on, you were then going to London to go.
Yes,
to
I had a year at home, and went to London the next year after they'd moved up and settled in Scotland. And then, when he retired from the civil defense school, they built a house in the valley, and it incorporated, my mother more or less designed it, I think, because it incorporated all the wonderful things she'd liked in all the houses that she'd ever lived in. And it got a bit too much for them, so they had to sell and move. And then Daddy died. And it was sad when we emigrated that when we said goodbye at like 2 o'clock in the morning on the tarmac at Prestwick Airport, that was the last time we would see him.
So where does David come into all this?
When I was in London as a student.
So you met him while you were going to drama school?
I'd dropped the drama school and was now studying voice. I wanted to be a singer.
Okay.
And who is David? David's
my husband. Her husband.
Sorry. Yes, he was a doctor in practice in London. He'd been trained at one of the big teaching hospitals in London through the war. And then he'd gone into private practice. And he was out one evening, and I met him with a date. I was on a date, and it was one of these funny little restaurants that one night, in the evenings, it was run as a Russian bistro. It was called Luba's Bistro. And in the lunchtime, it was a French restaurant, and they served all night's French food. And right next door to it was a very nice pub called the Admiral Codrington. And if you wanted any wine with your meal, you had to go next door to the Admiral Codrington and get a bottle of wine. But nobody thought any too much about it.
Yeah, that was just a common thing.
You didn't have to put it in a brown bag or take it.
Now, he was a bit older than you, right?
Yes, he was, Yes, he was born in the 20s.
Hmm, okay.
He had his 90th birthday last year.
Oh, is he leap day or something?
No. But I had a special champagne tea for him. And our daughter and her husband, who were living in Israel at the time, flew out to have the birthday. Stayed overnight and flew back to Israel the next day.
Oh, I thought you said 19th birthday, his 90th birthday.
90th.
I thought you were making some joke.
No. No, I think it'd be more than 19 anyway.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. So you were going to voice school and you
Well, my professor was a voice teacher, had been a tenor of some repute. He'd sung with Chaliapin and people like that between the wars. And he had made his name at the Stockholm Royal Opera House there. And then he turned to teaching. And amongst his students were Jussi Björling and what's her name? The Wagnerian soprano. Oh, yes, you could. I'll think of it at the end, yes. Anyway, she wasn't Kirsten Flagstad, but it was the one that everybody is still talking about because she was an incredibly good, very tall, very dramatic woman who I met very briefly when I was doing my music degrees in Dallas.
Mm-hmm. So did you, how soon after you met David, did you guys decide to get married?
Well,
did you date for a long time?
No, we met on bank holiday weekend in 1954, which was the first Monday in August. And he proposed a couple of weeks later. And we got married that December.
So it was a whirlwind romance.
Sort of. And then my parents were a bit upset. They weren't sure that they trusted him. But
That's okay. Karen and I got married after. We started dating and got married 5 months later, so...
Well, that's fine.
If it works out,
that's a reason,
yes. If it works out. So, how long did you continue to go to school after you got married?
I kept on with my voice lessons.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And
lived
the life of Riley. Actually, it was wonderful because we had a lovely little flat overlooking Hyde Park. We could see the Serpentine from our windows.
And what's the Serpentine?
It's the lake in the middle of Hyde Park.
Oh, okay.
Where they have all kinds of boat races and things. And it's a tradition that on New Year's Day, they go in and break the ice and swim.
Mm.
And
did you ever do that?
No, but our daughter did. And we'd go to the opera and the ballet and the theater and dinner parties and all sorts of things. A very elegant lifestyle.
Did you have any big performances during this time?
Mm-mm. But there were lots of things to go to with big performances.
Yeah, yeah. You know. Yeah. So you were enjoying the arts.
And indeed, yes. And we did see some wonderful. This was when Margot Fonteyn and her partners were tops because they were young and doing all the things they used to do, you know. And opera singers. I remember going to operas and seeing people. And David took me to all sorts of things. I'd never been to a ballet until he took me.
Really? Mm-hmm. That's so surprising.
Yes, I know. And
did you have that sort of any kind of arts that you encountered growing up in India? Did that
only through my father, really, in the books? He'd go to the library,
but not like a lot of performances.
Oh, nothing.
Music performances, nothing. Stage performances. It's interesting that you got so interested in the stage and in vocal and when you didn't really, you only sort of got exposed to it.
But you'd read about it in the books, you know, and hear about it and dream about it. And you go through all these cycles. I dreamed of having a horse of my own for a long time.
Did you ever get a horse of your own?
No, but I got a pony when I was 4 years old.
Well, there we go. It's what every girl wants.
No, my mother, the thing was that the barracks would have lots of horses that were used for tradition, you know, for usual, but also in parades and things when they were showing off, and they needed exercising. So they were available for anybody who was in the station or wherever to have as a rental without mm-hmm. even paying for it, you know, come with its own size. And Mummy would get a horse always because she'd grown up riding horses, and she saw no reason why her children shouldn't also. So she and I would go galloping off into the jungle from time to time. And when I got old enough to go with her, which was fun. And those were some of the memories that I have, you know, which are very pleasant.
So let's go back to England. How long were you and David in England?
Not long. We were long enough to have a baby. We left in January 58. David went over. He'd, without telling me the rat, that we were looking at transferring our allegiance because he wanted to practice medicine as he had trained to do. When they brought in the National Health, a lot of these doctors were made clerks. They were sort of had to fill out lots and lots and lots of notes and send their patients to somebody else, which didn't sit well with him. So we went to Saskatchewan.
So he kind of was...
He was looking in the pages.
Escaping the health National Health System.
Yes, part of the what they call the brain drain.
Huh.
Yes. And so we left, went to the prairies, because in those days, parts of Canada had what they called reciprocity with English degrees. So he didn't have to sit any exam to practice in Saskatchewan. But he wanted to move somewhere a little closer to civilization. And so he took his Canadian boards in Manitoba the year after we moved there, and then we moved down to Ontario.
Okay. Yeah. Well, see, I had always thought that you were over in that part of Canada, and when you said Saskatchewan, that kind of surprised
yes.
me, because that I was going and that at that point in time, I would think Saskatchewan was a pretty wild place.
No, not really. It was just very flat, and the little town we were in was called a city, and I couldn't understand it, because in England, you're not a city unless it's a cathedral. That's what gives it the name,
right.
the title. And this was a city of 5,000 people, and I remember asking somebody what that meant, and she said, it's got 5,000 people, and that's including the half-breeds, she said, of which there were plenty.
Yeah. But you weren't there very long in Saskatchewan.
We were there from, I joined David in March, and we left a year the following July.
Okay.
Because Neil, our child, had his second birthday in Minot, North Dakota. We're on our way.
When you're way to Ontario.
Yes. We went to the Lakehead, which is now called Thunder Bay.
Yeah.
Yeah. In those days, it was twin cities, Fort William and Port Arthur, because they had two railway lines, the Canadian Pacific and the Canadian National. And they'd built their own hotels, and they had their own railway lines, and they had their own routes.
So comparing, you know, grew up in India, lived in Scotland, lived in England, now you're in Canada. What, you know, how did all this compare for you? I mean, were you happy in Canada?
No. But if it hadn't been for the library, I think I'd have gone mad.
Wow.
But small as the town was, it had a wonderful library. And I would come home armed with books and just bury myself in romances that took me away from reality.
So what did you not like about Canada?
Well, there was nothing to do.
It's kind of isolated.
Yeah. And the only other people who really did much in the way of entertaining were the other Brits, who were also immigrants and would have little dinner parties and things.
Mm-hmm.
But the only city that had anything was Saskatoon, which was 100 miles south. And we'd occasionally go there for community concerts and things like that, but we weren't there all that long. Fort William had not much more than that. And then Oakville, outside Toronto. Yes, you could go into Toronto. It was quiet town. It didn't have many restaurants where you could get wine with your meals. And now, of course, it's just a thriving metropolis.
Right, right.
It's a lovely city because my sister and her husband live there, and I've visited them a number of times. But we made some very good Canadian, very good friends. One particular Canadian, French-Canadian family we still stay in touch with, and others that are real friends that you keep the links going all the time. And then your children, you just, everywhere you go, you make friends with people who have children the same age. And that was our situation, certainly, until we came to Little Rock.
How long did it take, how long were you there in Canada?
About 4 years.
Okay. And then you...
Went to Texas.
Texas. Again, such a, I mean, you know, this is why I wanted to try to go through all this. I mean, you've just had these huge switches from one place to another. Yeah. I mean, about the only thing that's been consistent is the English language, you know, which you've more or less been able to maintain in the places that you've lived.
But Texas was a revelation because it was not what I was expecting.
What were you expecting?
We went to Tyler. Uh-huh. Texas, which is lovely. It's got tall trees and red soil. And one of the places we were in India had red soil.
Mm-hmm.
And this suddenly, it smelt like India. And the mimosa trees looked like the trees that I grew up with in India. So there was a feeling almost of recognition.
So moving to Texas as compared to Canada was kind of a...
Yeah.
It ended up being a relief.
Well, sort of. But I took piano lessons at Tyler Junior College. all the little girls in Tyler wanted to be Apache Bells. Apache Bells.
Apache Bells.
Apache Bells.
And what is that?
It's the name of the... I guess you call it...
Indian princesses, right?
But the Tyler Junior College had cheerleaders for their football
team. Oh, it was their mascots.
And they were called the Apache Bells.
Yeah, okay.
And then we moved to Dallas, and the children went to good schools, and I went to university to start my degree and got my music degrees at Dallas.
What inspired that? I mean, you know,
after...
It had been many years, since you'd been in school.
The piano teacher that I went to in Tyler. And he said, why don't you? Because he realized that I wasn't interested in going to church or joining bridge clubs and things like that. And he said, so I explored it and went to somebody to talk to at SMU and got some very good advice that I would never have gotten in a similar situation in England. It was very generous and kind and allowed me to take the GED. And he came out after I'd taken it. He said, I think you wrote this paper. Which was... not math, English and history. But I thoroughly enjoyed my years at SMU. It was great fun. I was among the vanguard of older women, older students going back. So I was a mature student when all these fresh 17, 18-year-olds were freshmen as well.
Not an uncommon thing now, but probably was at that time.
Yes, and the faculty didn't really know how to take me. Because they almost expected me to put them down, I think. But when they realized I knew nothing, I was learning from the ground up. And they taught me, and it was exciting to be able to do what I needed to do.
It was the going back to your school in Scotland that you loved so much.
Yes, and, sort of. And I was of an age when I really wanted to learn. And I actually learned to pass the SAT, even the math I passed. Because I had this wonderful teacher in Dallas College who... taught algebra that made it understandable. Now, if I'd had somebody like that when I was 14, 15, I probably could have kept it. But, I did it for the purpose I had it, and I've forgotten it all since.
And then how long were you in Texas?
10 years.
10 years.
Yes, and then we moved to Kentucky.
Okay, and how long were you in Kentucky?
3 years.
3 years.
And then we went to Ohio.
Ohio. How long there?
3 years.
3 years.
And then down here.
Anything spectacular in Kentucky or Ohio?
Oh, lovely. I loved Kentucky. Yeah. It's a life apart, really. We had a lovely house in a lovely part of Lexington, and the children seemed to be settling in. Our daughter, of course, went off to school because she wanted to do ballet, and there was nothing in the area, so she went to school in Washington for a year. And then when we moved to Dayton, there was a very good ballet company there. And she danced with them for a while, but then she wanted something a bit more intensive. So she finished her high school in New York.
What are your children's names?
Oh, our son is called Neil. And it's spelled N-I-A-L-L, which is pronounced Nile over here. So he calls it Nile now because he got tired of telling,
telling people his name.
And our daughter is Dido. And neither of them have a second name.
Really?
Yeah.
Why was that?
Well, we couldn't figure out what to call them.
What goes with...
And we figured that if they had a gap there, then they had the option of choosing their own name.
They could come up with something later on.
And Dido got, she was very artistic and very sporty. They both were. She was a great swimmer and diver, and Neil was very good at swimming and football and all these other things. And she went into ballet and went to school in New York and then across to England and trained over there and danced professionally for a number of years with companies in Canada and England. And then she got injured, so she had to go back to school. And she opted to stay in England and took what they called O-levels and A-levels in those days. And ended up doing occupational therapy, and she's now a doctorate in occupational therapy and has a position with a university in Oxford.
So we're getting close to the end, but
I haven't asked you any questions.
Right, and you're not going to, obviously. So we need to talk about Little Rock, and after hearing all the places you lived, Little Rock must not have been as big of a change as I kind of always think it when people move to Arkansas. I always think it's a huge cultural change, but not if you've lived in Texas.
No, we got adapted to the American way of life. And I was telling my friends that I was not frightened when Neil went to university over here because I'd been on a university campus myself.
Right.
And it was familiar, so it didn't worry me as much as it seemed to people whose children were suddenly landed in an American campus. But it was here, because Dido was still in training, dancing, wanted to stay close. She was in England and a long way away. I got very much involved with Ballet Arkansas here. And then from that, with other arts events and with the radio, when it was just KLRE over in Scott Hamilton Drive.
Right, Metropolitan.
Mm-hmm.
So how long have you been here in...
We came here
Arkansas.
In 78, so that's 30, how many years?
Whatever. We'll turn to her to do the math, 34 or something?
Something like that, yes.
Which is the longest you've ever lived anywhere.
Anywhere,
right?
Yes. Indeed.
Are you happy to be here?
Oh, yes. We've got some very good friends, and I couldn't be doing what I'm doing now, which I love so much, if I were anywhere else now, because I sort of eased into it. It wasn't something that I went looking for, but it's been great for me.
Well, I know the radio thing was just... it seemed, when I look back on it, it seems like it was almost by accident that it occurred.
And I was more or less given the total freedom to make of it what I could.
Right. And because you were originally, there was the, I think maybe it was just you did a couple of interviews and then got, you suggested the Forgotten Oscar series or how did is that how it worked out?
Well, no, I was doing the Sampling the Arts, remember?
No, I don't remember that one.
That was the one like Zabel Stodler's Speaking Volumes and things, and I did it for all the arts for a similar, 90-second
and
a couple of minutes.
And how did that come about? How did you end up doing
I
that?
I wanted to use my degrees because I've been working on my master's in musicology, and Dick Sieber at the music school, he was the chairman of music at UALR, suggested I see if somebody would like me if I sort of took a class, but I had to sort of create my own environment and nobody signed up. So then he said, well, go to the radio station and see if they'd like to use you. So John said, fine, yes, I'd love to do something like this. And he more or less drew the idea of the sampling. And then when KLRE moved on campus with KUAR, the dean at that time was Lloyd Benjamin, and he said he wanted a program at a regular time each week on the arts in Arkansas. And he wanted me to do it.
Yes.
So that's how I did.
And thus his history is born.
Or
let's
whatever.
See. Whatever. I think we determined the art scene is... you had your 25th anniversary a few years ago.
1985 we started.
Yeah. So
October the something.
So, yeah, we're way beyond that. So, what would you say, summarizing your experience with doing the art scene for all these years?
Well, I look back and we've got the same format, but I've got more ambitious with the people that I have and the way that I try to put the program together to appeal to the whole state rather than just the immediate central Arkansas. which doesn't go as far as I'd like it to, but it seems to reach people because this is a state that's very much a family. There are people who live here or who pass through to somewhere else if they hear something that I've got on the program. They seem to be able to take interest in it and take mm-hmm. advantage of it. And it's been wonderful. I've met some marvelous people.
I was going to say, you've gotten to talk to just some amazing people over the years. Yeah. You know, what would be your highlights of folks that you've gotten to talk
with? I don't know. I've been asked that before, and I've had so many. When you realize that once a week, two interviews each week for that many years, some repeats, but at a different level. You know, I've done regular interviews with people from the symphony and the rep and the mm-hmm. runs of past seasons, etc. But they're all interesting.
Visiting artists yes, and authors.
Yes, and phone interviews with the great and the good. Mm-hmm. And it's very gratifying to be able to do that. You know, to be hugged by James Earl Jones.
Because that's a guy that can hug, I bet.
Yes, because you've done an interview to when David Itkin had those Black History Month
right.
concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And that other chap that did things, he was a cop on television with what's his name, who was the Scot who died for Scotland. What was his name? The actor. Who was always in trouble with the law because he drinks too much.
Oh, Mel Gibson.
the black guy who played.
Oh, Danny Glover.
Yes,
Danny
he came
Glover.
Here
we
too.
Had to go to Mel Gibson to get to Danny Glover. But yeah, Danny Glover. Yeah. That's right. I remember, yes.
Yeah. And it's. I mean, these are people that I'd never get to talk to otherwise, that I can enjoy having some conversation. And with James Earl Jones, we talked about the South African playwright that he had done such good work with. Mm-hmm. And so we weren't talking about his own career or what might have been traditional questions. You mm-hmm. know. But it's been fun.
I'm wondering, actually, is there, you've probably seen, of course, so many performances, but I'm wondering if there's one that stands out in your mind that just moved you or changed you in some way.
Oh, you mean
a performance that you
that
attended?
I've been to, yes. Yeah. Well, I've been to a lot of operas that have really moved me. There's one that we went to that was much touted in England at the time because Maria Callas was very much top of the tree. And she was singing Norma, it was the big Bellini opera, with a contralto called Ebi Stignani, who was well past her prime. But in the big duet that they have at the end of the, towards the end of the opera, the Ebi had obviously waited for this because she sang Callas off the stage. It was amazing, the quality that she brought that showed how dramatically Callas could sing and how marvelous she could act and how beautiful she looked. But when the two voices blended, you suddenly saw or heard the difference in the approach to the things in the music and the way the music was written. It was really quite remarkable.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Where was that?
In London.
In London.
Yeah.
Was that back in those glory days or when
oh,
you were?
Yes. Oh, yes. No, it was one of those things that you didn't get to go to more than once.
Right.
Really. No. No, there's so many that I can't obviously just pull out of the hat, but no, we've seen some marvelous performers and performances go back a long way.
I think we're about out of time, I guess.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's
you want to ask me one question?
I'd like to ask you one question.
Okay.
Have we been talking about things that you really wanted to talk about?
Yes, because I have never been able to figure out when you were in India, when you were in Canada, when you were in England. I've never been able to. I knew all these places
existed
in your life, but I could never put it in any kind of a linear position. So.
No,
it's
like,
exactly what I wanted to know.
It's like an etch-a-sketch.